Hello, I'm Jeremy Rivera, your unscripted podcast host. I'm here with Joshua Ramsey. Go ahead and introduce yourself and tell us why we should trust you.
I love it. How do you trust me? I don't know if you can trust anybody these days, right? But I'm Josh Ramsey. I'm a fractional chief marketing officer. I also have a full stack ad agency and a software development company that's out there and exists. So, as far as why to trust me, I'll tell you what I tell people that show up at my conference or look at hiring me in the first place is I treat you the way I want to be treated. That's the way I was raised. That's the way I approach the world is if I wouldn't do it for myself, if I'm not already doing it for myself, I wouldn't recommend it and do it for anyone else. Therefore, when people come in and they go, well, explain that, like prove it. I love using the word with my project managers, prove it. The client said this didn't happen. You said it did. Prove to me that it happened. And the way I can prove it to people is I can show them my marketing, what I do, my PR for myself. Then people are able to see it. And then I'll give you one last drop. If people type in the word fractional CMO, Dallas, Austin, Houston, Tampa, Los Angeles, Boise, Denver, about 32 different major cities in the U.S., I show up at minimum on page one, most of them in the top five, and the key cities that I target, number one. So that's what I would say, trust me.
Nice. All right. Well, so what's your background? Give me what was the first thing you ever did as a job, and then the last thing you did before you did this?
So the first thing ever was actually I worked at my dad's printing company, and I was very little, so he tasked me with taking labels about the size of a business card and putting them on boxes. So whenever they printed business cards, they would go in the box, but the box was branded with his company name on it. So that was my first job. So I understood printing. I cleaned printing presses. That was in the 80s and 90s. So that was my first job. And then what was the second part there, Jerry?
The last job you did before you did what you do now as a fractional CMO.
I'll try to keep it condensed, but I worked for a top 100 ad agency, became senior VP of marketing and sales. Then I started my ad agency. Then I started my software company, and now I'm a fractional CMO, but I still own those three divisions of companies now.
So I've had a couple of conversations in the past, and I've considered wearing the fractional hat at certain points. I've worked both in-house on SEO, at an agency, and freelance consult. So I've rubbed shoulders. I've worked with fractional CMOs for fractional CMOs. So what is it about that concept that is so attractive right now? Whereas I don't think that even the idea of a fractional CMO was an idea even 20 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, I would even go as far as saying that fractional CMO wasn't really even truly developed or on the radar until about 2021, 2020 maybe. But I started doing this in 2018. I think that first of all, what I would say is fractional chief marketing officers, I think there's a little bit of a gray area and unknown part because of just who thinks that they can enter that market. So I know the major competitors that I have in the market. I know their price points. I've done all of my studies on it. Here's what I would boil it down to. If someone's looking at a fractional chief marketing officer, you should look at their resume and mainly acknowledge and note in their resume that they've done more than just digital. Because just digital means really you are a consultant, a high-level, super experienced consultant when it comes to digital marketing. But it's different when you start trying to evaluate how do we do placements in other locations, such as programmatic. So programmatic is what I would consider right now on the rise. I'm even seeing commercials for it when 6, 12, 18 months ago, there were no commercials for it. I was doing it, but there were no commercials. So my background has been in print with doing newspapers, magazines, mailers, to billboards, transit advertising with companies like Lamar and CBS Outdoor, to television with CBS. So I've done all these different things. So my background, my media placement, my media sales history carries a lot more weight versus just people that have the experience of digital marketing. I see ads all the time that I feel like mislead potential consumers of marketing. And those ads are, hey, you own an ad agency, you should be a CMO. And I'm looking at it going, a CMO is not just somebody that does just one thing. It's they need to be holistic of what's best for the company, and then make the strategy decision of what's best for the company as holistic, not just digital, not just outdoor, you know what I mean? Or just trade shows. They need to know all of it. It's what I believe to be true and what I studied in college and and what I hear and see today as I study on.
As a CMO, you probably have to present to the CEO or to the board. And if you're looking cross-channel, which I definitely agree, you need to be, looking at beyond just digital. I'm super focused down on SEO, but I know that there's a bigger, broader world beyond that. And I'm curious, how does the metrics that I would be used to in SEO carry over to other channels? Is there a throughput in each of these channels that are equivalent? Are they under different labels, but they mean the same thing? And so can you connect this any singular metric across the board? And if so, which one do you look at? Which one's the most important?
I think every attribution point and every channel, marketing channel that you have is going to draw and give a different ROI. I think the expectation from a CMO in general, let's forget the word fractional, but a CMO in general, the expectation needs to be tempered and set properly, and the proper KPIs set with the CEO. When you set those proper KPIs, the CEO and you are on the same page. Therefore, the longevity and the focus and growth of the company is better. So now let me take you back to what you were asking and try to answer it. If I don't, feel free to ask me in a different way. But where I start is understanding the goal of the company. More than just growth, what type of growth? What do we want? I've got a client right now. They are, in short, because I want to protect their identities, but they're a trucking company. And they put drivers on the road. They basically connect drivers with the companies like Walmart, and they put them together to get product on the road in the trucks. So they want to focus on their reputation, their PR. Their goal is not really SEO. Their goal is more of PR and getting more sales reps into their office. They want to grow by having sales reps and boots on the ground. But they're also understanding that it is tied to SEO. It is tied to visibility online, but we can't just focus on that. So we're taking an approach of cleaning up their directories, cleaning up their listings, building authority in their website, but then also we're taking an approach of social media. So the goals and the concept is different than just SEO, but SEO is always a foundation. But I don't always call it SEO, I call it CRO, client retention optimization, visibility. Because these become different strategies. I mean, I can give you a million stories. I'll keep it short to another one. A roofing company. They were doing great in visibility. They were doing great with backlinks. They were doing great with driving people to the site. But the average person on a roofing company was staying on for under 20 seconds. And we had this massive number of people, and the agency kept telling the business owner, "This is amazing. We're killing it." And the business owner goes, "My phone volume. My calls have not gone up. It's the same. So I'm spending extra money, but my volume of calls hasn't gone up. You're showing me metrics of growth, but my call volume hasn't gone up." So through a series of obstacles and challenges, we've now moved to an agency that's focusing on the CRO, the client retention optimization. And now, just 2 months in, we're already seeing the steady calls go up. Not just because of season, storm season, where they are, but incrementally, year over year, we are seeing growth with a smaller amount of spend as what we were doing before. However, I still would agree that it was a great step with that other agency. The problem is that they weren't agile enough. That other agency did not want to move from what they had sold and what they were doing and move to another strategy to make the phone ring more. They said, this is what you bought, this is what you get. And I said, if you don't become agile and work with me, I'm not going to be able to stay and recommend this to my boss, my CEO. Ultimately, we had to make the change. So I don't know, hopefully maybe that answered some of it, but high tide raises all ships. When you do enough of multiple things, you can see your web traffic increase.
No, I love that. And it's also a story of where if the metric you're looking at are growing, but it's not the metric that moves the business, then you're wasting a lot of effort trying to spin that wheel, spin that, you know, do those things. And it does require flexibility. I've been in those situations where, you know, we had a very successful ad campaign and, you know, the form submits were actually really good, but the salespeople weren't able to close them because they weren't targeting somebody that actually had access to buy the thing. They didn't have the approval. It was like a longer, you know, funnel or chain that required more. And so we had to go, you know, it requires that stepping back and saying, okay, we did this, we had success, but it's not the right kind of success. And I think that takes a honesty on your side as a marketer and also a good line of communication with the end client or your sales team. So it's kind of a communication between teams. So how do you structure your organization to create those opportunities to clarify progress?
Well, I think that kind of goes back to the KPIs, and it's not just the CEO and the CMO saying this is what it is, but it's the full circle. It's interesting because for me, the actual target, when I target to grow my company, I focus more on the CFO, the financial officer, because the CFO is looking at the numbers. And what happens, I've learned, and I understand this, even in my own companies, that the business owner walks into the office of the CFO, says, where's my money? Why do I not have more money? And the CFO goes, well, you spend it on this, this, this. And the CEO goes, we'll cut something and make me more money. CFO goes, well, we can cut marketing. And everyone goes, yeah, marketing's the first to go because we got to have operations and we've got to have sales and we've got to have, you know, the shipping and all this other stuff. So cut marketing. I'm like, wait, if you don't have money coming in, you don't need those other people. So what's it going to be, right? And I think every business is going to be a little bit different as well, because then you focus on, do you need salespeople to execute or do you need the marketing to generate the leads? So I'll use another example. I'm working with a restoration company. They have offices all the way from Baltimore down to Miami. And this company focuses on getting in front of business owners to build a plan, what we have dubbed the ERP, Emergency Response Plan. But what they haven't done, and the reason they're bringing me in, is that they're looking at it and they're saying, hey, our salespeople need leads, but they're also supposed to generate. But there hasn't been enough time for the CEO or the former marketing director or knowledge wherewithal of the former to be able to say, how for one salesperson, how much volume do you need from marketing? How much volume should they be doing themselves? Well, they don't have really a true sales manager. They have managers of sales, but not like a VP of sales. So they haven't set that. So sometimes for myself, I step into that sales manager role to be able to help the sales workers say, this is the expectation that we want. I want you to have 50 a month. Marketing is going to give you 25. Then on the marketing side, we allocate the money for the attribution channels to drive in leads and all the KPIs there. Then I say, okay, sales group, you have to provide the other 25. right? Or do 20 and 5 is referrals or however you want to do it. But that's the sales side. I've done a lot of sales. I do some sales for clients where I step in as a manager or at least consulting on that. I don't get that heavy into it. I have other partners that I can refer to, but I do step in enough to be able to set those expectations, knowing this is where we want to get to. What do we need to do? And that, again, that's holistic. So it does become a conversation of what does the CEO want? What does the CFO need us to perform at? What is the sales manager doing? What is operations doing? Because I like to know what the inner working is. What is it that makes us the most margin? That feeds everybody else, including the CMO, the marketing officer. So hopefully that answers your question again. But it's just a collective group to set the proper KPIs to know what's the vision of the company provided by CEO, with everyone around the CEO asking, how do all these pieces come together? And because I've been an owner of my own companies for so long, I've failed on some of them, and I've succeeded on a lot more than I failed. That's why I'm able to do what I do. But that's what we look at as a holistic.
I'm curious. I have a few SEO friends, and one's Michael McDougall, and he has a project where I would say he just has a habit of finding clients that are in a boring space. It's not like a capo luxury vacation. One was toilet partitions, and now he's looking at stair handrails. So when you don't have something that's like, oh, hey, that's sexy. Hey, that's a car. That's nice. How do you adjust your marketing campaign to boring? You know, to find, how do you find the value, find the interesting in boring? What's your strategy for that challenge?
You know, Jeremy, it's almost like we had a conversation before this, and we didn't. But you kind of have like thrown me softballs of, hey, hit this out of the park. So another perfect, for instance, I just had a meeting before our podcast here, and it's with a concierge doctor. So it's a private doctor that comes to your home. You pay an initiation fee, then you pay monthly, then you pay like service fees, right? So I kind of knew that they existed, but I didn't really know that they existed, right? Like, I didn't know the affordability. I didn't know the services. There's so much I didn't know. I had no idea. Well, this was a referral, came to me, called me up, said, I've been looking at different marketing companies. I don't know who to choose because I hear this, I hear this, I hear this. So my answer was, again, I use this word quite a bit on this podcast. Don't mean to, but holistically, her goal is to grow. So what we are doing with her specifically is we built a plan built on several pillars. And I show these plans on my website and talk specifically about what they are. So I have three plans. The base plan is a baseline SEO plan, digital marketing. What are you doing? How are you doing it? The next plan is more big picture. Where do you want to go? Who's your avatar? What's your budget? What's the expectations? And then the top tier is we actually run ads for a couple of weeks. We update website pages so that they perform better. We run ads specific to the strategy, and then we give the results so they can create a more clear, accurate budget. So with this particular doctor, what we are doing right now, and they're in the middle of, is we've already outlined what the website pages need to be. Because everyone that we're going to advertise to will come back to that page if they're interested. So we're updating the content of the page to really hit the hot buttons that will match all of the messaging that we put out there. Then we're running meta ads. With meta, our messaging is focused on a core set of keywords that most consumers will easily remember and understand if they're interested in our service. Therefore, when they go do a search, because her SEO isn't up to snuff and it will take a while to get there, we're running Google Ads to counterbalance what the website wants to rank for but is not. What Meta is advertising with that message that we want to trigger their mind to remember, right? Then we're running Google Ads to try to catch those people that may forget about it. Right? Everyone scrolls on their toilet, on through their phone, right, and watches the little videos and stuff. So we're trying to be like, hey, drop the message, get it in their mind. Then when they go Google later on, or they're there and they're waiting long enough to move to the doctor, that's the focus, right? So that's the goal. Now, I can go a little bit deeper if you want, but that's kind of that first picture there.
So it's almost like figure out a way to define some demand generation, because there's probably not, it's not going to exist. And I like the example of like thinking of it in three different steps and channels, because if her SEO isn't up to snuff, then she's not going to be there when they search for that. So you have to catch that. But in order to, like, if there's no volume for that search in Google to begin with, then you have to create the interest through yet another channel to reach and then push them. So you're, it is a problem in SEO where a lot of practitioners are very reactive. Our first thought is, hey, I need to look at SEMrush. What has volume? I'm going to optimize for it. And like, okay, well, that's okay-ish in an industry where there are people searching for that thing, but there's not a lot of people searching for toilet partitions, you know? So, you know, you gotta do the extra steps to look at, you know, well, who would buy those? And, oh, well, if somebody's renovating a space, they're buying a new restaurant, they're buying a new building, they're potential business owners, they're entrepreneurs. That just unlocks so many different channels of or contractors becoming aware of all of the different options that they can save money in their proposals. Architects, you know, so opening that channel up to looking at prospectively who is doing this, then you can find alternate channels where you can funnel people's interest from here to that and then generate the search volume.
Yeah, so let me ride those coattails for a minute and give you another strategy when it comes to the bathroom partitions. I could give you another example literally of yesterday. Had a meeting with a lady that owns a company doing very successful, spending only $500 a month in marketing. And she's doing almost $1 million in sales a year. So she's doing very, very well, okay? Because she's got great volume and she's got great, you know, gross profit margin there. So same thing with her as the bathroom. When you have something that's specialty that not everybody thinks about, not everybody wants, it's a small segment, there's always going to be the portion of search volume inbound that they are looking for it. They do want it. So optimizing for it is still smart. But having your website built properly with proper navigation is part of SEO, but that's the CRO, right? I call it control the user's navigation. The user coming in, they don't really know what they're looking for, but they're not looking to read your blog. When they come looking for something, they don't want to read your blog. The blog may bring them in, being SEO to bring them in to learn more, but they're never going to go from your homepage to your blog. You're going to see such a small part of that. So now we look at other attribution points. So I oftentimes create what I call as a knockdown list. The knockdown list is to identify the specific targets that we know will buy what we sell some point in the next 6 months, 12 months, or 2 years. But we know that we want to be top of mind to them. So when we do that, we take specific steps and measurements of touch points. And we try to get people to opt out, because as we can cycle through them, when they opt out and don't want to create that relationship, we want to focus all of our attention on the people that go, yes, I want to know more. Yes, let's go. So now it becomes the knockdown list, because what we're trying to do is knock them down, get rid of them to focus on the percentage of people that we know are interested in talking to us. And we may say, you don't have a bathroom project right now. You may not have a pond project right now. But when you do, this is us. Can we be in your Rolodex? Can you save my number to your phone? Won't bug you, but maybe twice a year. But can you save me in your phone so the next time you have a problem, you have a need, you know that you can go to your phone and type in that keyword. Here I am. You're going to find me. Yeah. Right? And that's a different strategy. But again, your SEO needs to match it, because when they save your number, they may go do some due diligence on you before they call you. So now they've got to be able to find you, and your user navigation has got to be on point.
Yeah, because you got to reinforce trust. You have to have those signals, you know, show that you're doing the work, showing that you've done the deeds, showing that you're the strongest in the market, you know, having those comparison pieces. I agree, there is been so much focus on, oh, I need you to do SEO. Go ahead and create 10 blog posts for me. You're like, no, that, okay, there is a strategy in terms of using content on your blog as part of the marketing, but so much more of that is attracting that traffic, you know, topically versus creating the parts of your site that, you know, are focused on the need at the moment and giving the social proof, giving the next step, having, you know, like what happens next? Like, how does a driveway get installed? Like, if you don't have those specifically labeled separate resources and you just get stuck into this, everything needs to be a blog post mentality, then you're definitely losing out.
Yeah, I think you said it well.
So next example that I wanted to move to is, how do you deal with regionality with a non-unique service? So, you know, I've done realtors before. Let's do, say, like a rehab center. You know, Achieve Wellness, they're in a particular place and they do rehab just like they do rehab in another part of the country. So when you have, you know, a non-USP as the core element, because it's not like a unique piece of software that does something radically different, how do you differentiate your brand, differentiate your site, differentiate your marketing significantly enough to make a difference? Or does it not need to be hyper differentiated? What path do you go down with that, you know, repeatable business model that's going to occur? You're just doing what somebody else is doing elsewhere in the country.
Yeah, I think there's two roads that I want to take down. The first one I'll keep pretty short. I'm working with a remodeler. I work with a lot of remodelers, just part of the business that I've always been in. And this one specific remodeler that's in mind is frustrated because he wants to sell the higher level projects. He wants to sell the, you know, $500,000 bathroom or kitchen and up. He wants those big ones. But when you look at his website, it doesn't portray this as a $500,000 kitchen. He thinks it does. But when I walk through the doors, stand outside a Neiman Marcus or whatever it's called, Nordstrom's or a Tiffany's, everyone knows what Tiffany's jewelry is. When I stand outside Tiffany's and I show them the website and I go, hey, here's two websites. If you were going to do a remodeling project, which website would you probably call first? It's never his. So stylistically, that has to be a big part of it. I'm trying to remember my second bullet point that I had. Remind me the question, Jeremy, because that was one part and there was another part.
It's regionality. You don't have a unique selling proposition. You're doing the same thing, just in a different location.
Thank you. So the unique selling proposition. I love that you brought that up because I talk a lot about that. And here's my take on a USP. And the answer is everyone has it. So I did a lot of studying on psychology. And the simplistic version, to keep it very short and direct, is that we all have what's called a narrative. And the narrative is what we have lived through to get to this moment in time. Anyone watching or hearing this podcast, this moment in time, you have had experiences in your life where you've made decisions. Jeremy, you asked me the same question about my USP when we first got on. And my answer was, I treat people the way I want to be treated. Because that's part of my narrative. It's part of my upbringing. So when I say that, what I need to do is say it, but support it. How do I do that? I supported it on the front end of this call, Jeremy, because I said, if I tell someone to do something, I've probably already done it for a client, therefore I can show you, or I'm doing it for myself, therefore I can show you. So that's part of my narrative, but it's also builds my USP, but there's also supporting evidence, therefore it's not a platitude. Because a platitude would be without supporting evidence that I go, I treat people the way I want to be treated. I'm the best general contractor. I'm the best, you know, home therapist. Great. Everyone says it. But you got to go deeper than that and not have on your homepage hero image, we do remodeling, we do home therapy, right? You got to go deeper than that and say more of what is it that made you go do that? Like, whatever you do for a living, what made you? What is your road? And why is it relevant to the consumers looking at consuming your product? That's where I go of what the true USP is, because there's always a story to who we are and why we are here right now.
So Morty Oberstein would call that brand and branding, which is a concept that SEOs, as of like 2 months ago, okay, maybe 2 years, had no conception of, couldn't care less about. But now that we see Google Search Console and we have the helpful content update indicating, you know what? It wasn't that the content wasn't helpful. It's that Google doesn't trust you because you don't have an established brand. Either you don't have the anchor text distribution indicates you're trustworthy enough, or the click distribution of people that are coming to you indicate that you're just there to soak up Google search volume, and they want to get rid of sites that are just there to get Google search traffic and appear to bias towards quote-unquote established brands. And you know, that opened the door to, oh, well, I just need to say the name everywhere that I possibly can. And, you know, brand marketers and you know, Morty Oberstein of Wix and others are shouting from the rooftops, wait, brand isn't just finding places to get your name placed on different sites. Now, I would say that that is arguably a very important and often ignored task for newer companies and companies that are working on their foundational SEO. I worked with a very well-established company right now, and nobody knows what Save Fry Oil is as a brand. Like, nobody's heard of it. But thousands of kitchens are using the tools that they sell. They just don't know that it comes from Save Fry Oil. So how do you bridge the gap and connect those two concepts of your USP, delivering that value, and the name?
So I always, I like to fight trends. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to argue the other side of that. I don't believe that a brand, I believe a brand is built based on the USP, but a USP is not the brand. You could get technical and argue and not agree with me that I'm not right. But here's what I mean with my concept. My concept is building a brand means that they're familiar with who you are. If you're found multiple times, for instance, if you Googled Josh Ramsey, you're going to see a Canadian punk rock singer and a professional soccer player who's trying to make it. I'm never going to beat those two because they're on such big platforms with so many followers that I'm not going to be there. Not right now, probably never a Canadian punk rock singer, because they're working with USM, Universal Music. So when they're working at Universal, they've got all of this brand power of Universal, and they push the brand of this person. But if you type in Josh Ramsey marketing, I dominate. Even though there's about four other Josh Ramseys that do marketing in the United States, they don't come close to where I'm at. They don't rank on the first two pages. It's all me. So you could say, oh, well, for your name, it's whatever. No, JRCMO is also my brand, but so is my name when it comes to CMO work. So my USP makes me the CMO. That's USP. But now you talk about branding with social proof. So I would say branding is more about social proof. If I do as many podcasts as I do, and I'm interviewed a lot by a lot of great podcasts like yours. You're very astute. You're on it. I'm really enjoying your questions and our conversations. There's podcasts that I get on that, honestly, I'm not a fan. And I would never go back, even though they've asked me to come back. That's just because of my feeling. But what I did achieve was my brand recognition being out there. So when your podcast mentions me, now all of a sudden, I have more notoriety, more social proof, more credibility. That's what Google wants. So as a builder of a brand, builder of a content concept, your USP makes you. But no one gives no one cares about your name. When I did a radio show for about 6 months, one that I'd always start with is, nobody cares what your name is. No one cares what the girl's name is. When I met my wife, I didn't care what her name was. Her name is Halcyon, which means peace and tranquility. She was a fitness model, had won the Ironman, was on a cover of a magazine. I was like, I don't know why she's going to talk to me. But she saw my narrative and became interested. So that's how we connected. My USP, my narrative is why. My brand, my name, she didn't care either. I didn't care what hers were. I looked at her, I go, you're gorgeous. I want to talk to you. I learned her name, and now, even now, I do care what her name is, but only because I care about the ethics, the morals, and the values that she brings to my life. Her name is her brand, but the USP is what makes me love the brand. So I think they are connected, but I think we get confused in not breaking it down in simplistic terms to understand what are the KPIs to grow my brand. Now we go back to your other question of what is a KPI? Like, how do you set the proper engagement and thought process with all the different executives? That's how, right? It's all of these things together.
Mm-hmm. I like that. It is hard at larger entities to define, you know, the ethics, the values, the morals of a company. And I find that that's even more true as the company scales. What's the largest entity you've worked with, and how do you as a CMO work with other C-suite to uncover that value proposition that they want to communicate, and then actually make that something that resonates all the way down to the customer support reps? Because I've been at an organization like that, like where it was a mom and pop shop, they grew out of a garage, and you know, then we're making a bunch of websites, and before we were bought out by Homes.com's evil step parent corpo nightmare company Dominion Enterprises, we did care, and we'd stay on the phone and solve problems that they had. We'd stay on the phone doing support until we fixed it. So how does a C-suite get that buy-in, make that actually happen without being saccharine drivel?
Yeah. My mind goes to two different stories that everyone should know. And if they don't, they need to go research these. But one would be Nike, and actually, I guess they're both Nike, but one is the offshoot of how they started, and then Jordan. So each of these stories are slightly different in how they rebranded. So with Nike starting, their narrative, their USP was they wanted a better shoe that had better traction. So we took rubber, put it in a waffle iron, closed it, then glued that to a shoe, and he had better traction. That's essentially how Nike got going. So yeah. Understanding the operations of a company tied with the narrative of why the business owner did it. Most business owners did not start their company because they were good at marketing. They started their company because they had a great idea and they felt like they could do it better than anyone else. That's a narrative. That's a USP that creates the brand. So when you look at Nike, they took the operations, the strategy, and they made that their marketing. So that's one part. Go to Jordan. They disrupted not just by signing this young kid that they thought was going to be good, but they didn't know for sure. But they disrupted because they put a shoe out that they had to pay a fine to the NBA every single game. And they made sure that that got publicized, that they believed, Nike believed in this person that much that they were going to pay for this shoe and get fined every single game. That's disrupting the market, but that's building a brand. And then where Nike hit pay dirt is because Michael Jordan became Michael Jordan. So that was hedging a bet. If you watch the movie about that, you'll see it, you'll understand it. But They took a gamble. They took a bet. It paid off for them. But that's where you look at those things. So if you take, reel that into someone listening to this and going, okay, well, how do I make that happen for myself? Go back to your USP. Why did you start doing it? Like, what is the brand? Why did you start doing it? Then take that story and start storytelling. Tell people why you did it, how you did it. The pond company I was talking about. We've only done one call, but the answer already is coming clear where she says, we go up against two other competitors. We win about 50% of the time. But she goes, 80% of the time, whatever they've done, those people come back to us and have us fix it because they broke it. So here's what we're doing. We're going in and we're going to start building the USP and the narrative. The USP based on the narrative that we win about 50% of our bids. But the other, when we lose that 50%, 80% of them come back to us to get it fixed. Find out why. What do you mean find out why? If I'm looking for that product and I hear that, not only am I thinking I want a pond, so my reticular activator is already looking for that, but now I'm opening up my marketing funnel and the cognitive bias where I go, if I learn enough from you and it seems to be true, maybe it is, right? That goes to puffery, which is Papa John's stamp of better ingredients, better pizza. Is it really? No, but they said it and the Supreme Court approved it and said it's puffery. That's how you bring this all together.
That's awesome. So as we wrap up, give me an action item. Most of my audience is SEOs, but there's a mix, but they're obviously interested in SEO and digital marketing in some aspect. Give us a piece of homework. Sit down, take X amount of time and do this to further what you said, to tap into that brand building, that USP. What's the action item? What are they going to sit down and do?
Sure. So the first thing is that I offer a 2-hour free consult. So anyone that's an SEO or watching this and they want to start working on their USP, their narrative, I like to know good ad agencies that specialize in different items because I do a lot of referrals. So I do a free 2-hour where I'll help you do what I'm about to suggest. So there's two ways you can do this. One, just sit down and write out whatever you live through. And I'm going to tell you how to do that. But write it out. Start thinking back in your history. Go to a quiet place that's comfortable, you enjoy, and not be bothered. Don't even take your cell phone to it, your computer. Spend at minimum 2 hours and write out why, you know, your story. A way to do that, this is kind of part two, but this is a good way to do it. Go research something called the trauma egg. The trauma egg is very interesting because it's an egg that you draw. So the fat parts at the top, the skinnier parts at the bottom, and you start by only drawing pictures with colored pencils, crayons, whatever you want. You draw a huge egg on a big piece of paper, and you start at the bottom, and you go, what's your first memory? And you draw it. Not write it, but draw that in memory. And then you keep moving up every age, every year, all the way to the top of what's the most impactful moment. The point to this is the impact. What you'll learn is your narrative. You'll learn by looking at it where your narrative intertwines. Now, I'm a very open and honest person. Sometimes that gets me in trouble, but I do it anyway. My narrative that I found was abandonment. I wasn't abandoned to some of the degree that others have been, but we all have our journey. And for me, mine resonated back with abandonment. Now, what that means for me and my journey today, when people come to my conference and they hear me talk and they hear me talk about the USP, I'm transparent about my history, what I've lived through and why. But the abandonment has made me better today. And that is part of why I say I treat people the way I want to be treated. The way I want to be treated is valued, cherished, loved, appreciated. So I'm going to do that to everyone that I work with. Therefore, my reputation of being a digital marketer since 2009 when I started my ad agency, I have zero bad reviews. I have something like almost 200 reviews on just Google that are all 5 stars. So the way I'm able to do that is I treat people the way I want to be treated. So I tell them exactly what I'm going to do and I do exactly what I said, right? Sometimes it doesn't work out well, but we, you know, Emily could be figure out how do we separate in a positive sense, right? Like, how do we make this good? Mm-hmm. That maybe it didn't work. We didn't have the right expectations. It failed. I screwed up. I'll pay you back, whatever it is. But that's where we work on that narrative to be able to draw it in. So again, the research that I would encourage someone to do is do the trauma egg, and then that will help you with your USP, and it will start to move you to your brand, which is what you want ultimately. If you're listening to this, you're probably looking for education and how to grow your business. So if you're doing that, you need to build a better brand. How do you build the brand? USP. How do you get USP? Narrative. It all starts to connect.
I love it. Thanks so much. I love that through line, drawing it all back together, USP, brand, all of these pieces clicking in. Thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate the conversation.
Thanks, Jeremy.